Welcome to Talking Success, the podcast series that focuses on everything fintech. I'm your host, Alan Franks, and each week I'll be joined by a series of experts in the field who have a wealth of knowledge to share. It's time to meet this week's guest, so grab a coffee and let's start talking success.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to yet another episode of Talking Success. I'm super excited to have our guest on today. We met a couple of months ago in Cape Town after an event, and Tracy and her team were very kind enough to invite myself and a couple of colleagues out for a very, very lavish dinner, which I won't forget because it was exceptionally nice. And we got talking about all things fintech, all things payments, deadlifting, which I'll come on to a bit later on, sort of the balance between, work and life balance, which was, I know, something that Tracy has mastered. And we'll find out a little bit more how she's done that during this episode. And also another topic, which anyone that's sort of listening to this will know, it's very close to my heart. And I'm not talking about crypto, but I'm talking about women in fintech and diversity and inclusion. So this podcast is going to be a little bit different to some of the other sort of recent ones where we've spoken more about sort of industry and things are going on, what's happening, which we will cover. But I really want to use this to find out a little bit more from Tracy in terms of how she's developed her career, because, just one look at her LinkedIn profile, it's mind blowing. I mean, she's worked for some of the biggest companies on the planet, starting off in the US, ending up now in Europe, in Madrid, and spent a long time sort of opening up new markets. So I'd love to delve a bit deeper into that. But before I go on, Tracy, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me on a Friday morning from Madrid. I'm slightly jealous.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm happy to speak on all of these topics. So thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure to meet you in Cape Town when I was last out there, and yes, Hope to see you again the next time I'm in Cape Town. So
I look forward to it very much. I might see you in Madrid or Dubai or Saudi or somewhere else in the world. You know, who knows? But Tracy, for those people that are tuning in and may not know you, do you want to give a quick intro into sort of who you are, what you do at the moment, and then we can cover off?
Sort of start of your career. Great. So I'm Tracy Birdsall, and currently I am the vice president of the geo expansion business development and commercial teams at Worldpay. So Worldpay historically had commercial teams in EMEA, essentially in the UK, US, and in Amsterdam. And we decided to kind of branch out in Europe, Middle East, and Africa and have commercial teams on the ground. So for the last 18, 24 months, I think we've launched into 13 new countries in terms of commercial teams. So currently, yes, responsible for the commercial teams in Spain, Italy, France. I launched in Germany, the Nordics, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, as you mentioned, Dubai, UAE, South Africa. We're doing a lot of things there. But yeah, I've been in fintech for quite some time. As you mentioned, I was at Visa prior, North America, running the CyberSource North America organization. And then, of course, IBM in my history. But I'm really enjoying where I'm at today. It's an exciting time to be with Worldpay, right? I mean, we can get into kind of some of the things that are going on in the industry and with Worldpay as we spin off from FIS, and we're just become a part of GTCR, which is a private equity organization based in the U.S. So we're really excited about the spinoff and things that are happening, the trajectory and growth that we anticipate with the spinoff. Yeah.
So I was going to come on to that because I think we'd be, naive not to talk about, Worldpay in the recent news. There's obviously been, an acquisition that's happened. What does that mean for Worldpay in terms of strategy? Is it sort of business as usual? Is it just literally different owners? What's going to change?
Wow. Look, our strategy is growth. Our strategy has always been growth. I don't know that that fundamentally for many organizations is much different, right? So we're really looking forward to the investment that the private equity firm has set aside. It's been mentioned in the news that at least the minimum amount that's been set aside is about $1.25 billion US dollars for acquisitions and technology advancements and that type of thing. So we're really excited for that. The expansion will continue, right? I mean, looking at 2024, the GCC, do we go for Saudi? In fact, in October, we'll be at Seamless Saudi Arabia. We're looking at other countries within the EU where we put commercial teams. We are licensed in the EU for direct acquiring. We are licensed in Dubai with our new category 2 direct acquiring license as well. And that's what we're looking towards is the growth, the continued expansion, investment, lots of investment that will come into the business through private equity. So yeah, we're very excited. The team is, we're still part Amazing. Owned by FIS, 45% actually. And that's great news because if you think about the trajectory of things like embedded finance with capital markets and treasury and banking, you know, it really continues the synergy that we have, something called Amplifier program we've been working on as we are Worldpay from FIS. Oh, and I have to show my Worldpay from FIS mug because I think this actually might end up in a museum one day if
I say I was going to say alongside the Wirecard, but I'm not going to put the two in the same bracket. No, I won't do that. Okay, very cool. So the expansion strategy has been mainly by M&A, or has it been organic?
Most recently been organic growth and expanding to these countries in terms of, you know, currencies, where we can make settlements in the local currencies, acquiring licenses that are direct. In Asia Pacific, for example, we just launched in South Korea. We're continuing to launch in Japan and China with, you know, Alipay and some of the very, very prominent APMs, as you can imagine, in these regions. Also in Latin America, we continue the expansion into Mexico and other areas. We're in Argentina already, in Brazil, of course. The expansion for Worldpay is quite vast. I mean, it's all continents, obviously South Africa. That's the reason we met when I was in Cape Town. And we're continuing to look at the continent of Africa as well, and including, of course, Nigeria and some other fast-growing areas of the world. Annually, we put out a global payments report. It's very popular, industry famous, I guess, report about the trends and where trajectories, total available markets and growth. So e-com growth in the areas that we're expanding in are more than double digits. In fact, if you look at and just the trends in general, so it's a really great report. If you haven't seen it, to go ahead and download the Global Payments Report. It's a free report that Worldpay puts together annually. But that's really, you know, we've done it organically. We've done it on a strategy of looking at where the needs are, where the merchant clients and consumer needs are from an e-com perspective, and where we can facilitate the best, right? And so next, I mentioned we're looking at the likes of Saudi. We're looking at, because GCC, right? We do have Dubai and UAE, but it's really kind of the next step to really enter into the Middle East. Some of the trends there, I don't know, like the Global Payments Report points out, BNPL is growing at 46% year over year. I mean, that's just a crazy number to think about. And the trajectory of where e-com is going there is also very high. I mean, even where I sit today in Spain and Italy, we're talking double-digit growth in terms of e-com. I think Spain and Italy might be higher. I think it's 14 or 16% year-over-year growth in e-com, which is fantastic considering the size. Yeah.
And Chris, is that the key metric you look at as a business in terms of e-com growth, whether it be sort of the logistics around that to enable that sort of e-com growth? There are obviously a number of factors. It's not just sort of one. But is that the primary indicator of whether the market is sort of ripe for work?
Look, we look at many factors. One of them obviously is growth, because our company is – so it's kind of like, is there a tide that lifts all boats, right? If there's a market that's actually growing at a certain pace – and we'd like to, you know, continue to grow at that pace as well, in addition to capturing market share, which means, you know, we try to coexist with our competitors, not a rip and replace model, so to speak. But how do we coexist and add value where other of our competitors perhaps don't have the capabilities? So we look at different niches as well, in addition to growth. But of course, growth is a factor. Total available market. I'd say we also listen to our current client and merchant base, right? So Worldpay is the largest acquirer in the world today. So we have many clients that have opinions on where we should go next, where they need acquiring capabilities, and beyond acquiring, right? So, I mean, Worldpay has, I think, about 57 products and services. So it could be an APM, could be a gateway necessity, fraud necessity that they have in a particular region that we're able to build out. Yeah.
Amazing. Before we get on to you, one last question about sort of industry, and then we'll get on to you. Let's talk about Africa. For those of you who don't know, and I must admit, I hadn't known this prior to sort of meeting you and having dinner, was that Worldpay have made an investment in a payments company here in Africa, Flutterwave, which I wasn't aware of. But it's a non-exclusive relationship. Could you explain what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think... we are processing with Flutterwave today, so in South Africa. So we don't have, you know, we have acquired capabilities with Flutterwave in order to settle in the country. So that's kind of like the first piece. I mean, they also don't have exclusivity with us, which is nice for them, right? So, I mean, they can work with different acquirers as they choose, or PSPs and gateways, et cetera. But yeah, it's a really good synergy. They have experience on the continent. So we're learning experience, having initial entry is through a partnership with Flutterwave. It's very, as you know, we had dinner together with Flutterwave while I was in Cape Town. So yeah, no, it's a really good synergy that we have together. And like you said, it's non-exclusive. I think the first round of investment, which it was a small piece of what Flutterwave's investment today total has comprised of, but FIS and Worldpay from FIS has been an investor in the initial stages of Flutterwave.
And the plans for the continent, because a lot of our viewers sort of tuning in are sort of operating the continent or have an interest in the continent. What's the plan?
Wow.
Are you allowed to share?
So the plan is, I mean, if you think about it, and I think I could mention what's in the news, right? And what's in the news, if you think about people like Visa has committed $1 billion over the next few years, I think through 2027, to invest on the continent of Africa. And they're really doing it through micro investments, smaller owned companies, ideas that are coming through there, as well as from, you know, a Visa, the unbanked population, you know, making sure that education and things like that and training are coming out throughout the entire continent of Africa. And so we know that that growth in the area of Africa in general is there. As we talked about earlier, you know, what's our measurement? What's our strategy? And it is a growth one, but it is also supporting our schemes like a Visa, like a MasterCard and the rest. And clearly we know that when $1 billion is committed on the continent, that there is definitely the trajectory for growth and the trajectory for us to be a player on the continent.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Amazing. All right. Exciting times. We'll look forward to it. I want to move on to a different subject now. Now, clearly you've had an amazing career. You've got to where you are through, I'm sure, a lot of hard work, a lot of determination. And I'm sure there's been some challenges as a wife, as a mother, as a gymnast. Am I like a gymnast?
Well, as a CrossFitter, I think some people say if you're a CrossFit, maybe it's a little bit of a cult, but
yeah, okay, let's go with CrossFit, right? And obviously, being a woman. Now, I don't know whether you're aware, but I've been involved in the African Women in FinTech and Payments community for the last seven, 8 years. Have been subjected, let's use that word, to a number of conversations between women that I've been invited to. And I've just been appalled, quite frankly, at some of the things women have been asked to do or told to do by their superiors in order to progress their career. We don't need to go into details. I'm sure people can, you know, sort of unpack that as they wish. And I'm not talking about 20 years ago. I'm talking about conversations a couple of years ago. So there is still a lot of bias. There's a lot of negativity. There's a lot of ambiguity around this whole area of, you know, women empowerment. Tracy, for our viewers that are listening, whether that be male or female, can you talk about your journey? And, you know, if there's anything that, or any advice you can give to people that are listening to this, again, whether it be male leaders, whether it be females that are either in leadership roles or aspiring to be leaders. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, happy to. First of all, thank you for being a part of the African Women in FinTech and Payments. I think that's the number one thing that, what, you know, it's more about, I could talk about my journey, but what are the things that we can execute and what can we change as individuals? And you being an ally to African women and in general, women in payments and fintech is a huge step forward, right? And we think that's it, right? We just need allies. It's not just about the fight for women, but it's a fight together because quite frankly, if you look at statistics, we know that diverse teams bring about, you know, higher revenues, bring about creative ideas. And if you think about it in fintech and payments, like who are the buyers? The buyers are women at the end of the day, right? I think it's something like 70% or more, depending on which country you're talking about, that the buying decisions are made by women in a household, everything from the grocery store, the, you know, where are we going on vacation? You know, they're the ones like kind of deciding with the kids what stroller we should buy or what, just everything out throughout a life cycle. So it's really important for us to have women in fintech and women in payments, because we need to understand that it's not just about the merchant and the client from our perspective, but who's the client's client? And in that case, the consumer is very much made up of the female population. Anyway, but my journey is an interesting one. I'm going to give away my age, I think. I started my career 27 years ago. And I think my first really entree into corporate or corporate America, if you will, was IBM. And back then, we did call it identical blue men, by the way, IBM. and it was very much true, although they were very progressive and supported in inclusion and diversity. But I think I started at a time where her ass was her ass. Can I say that on the podcast?
You can say that. You're more than welcome to say that. Yeah, that's fine. You said it not wrong. That's fine.
Yeah, where, you know, her ass was her ass. And it was like, I think, you know, women have had the challenge to really prove themselves that they should be in those positions. I mean, for example, when I was at IBM, I went and got certified in service-oriented architecture. So you're talking about application server layer, enterprise service bus, and up the stack, right? And I was in a sales role, and I wanted to prove myself as a woman. I think I shocked a lot of men in the room when I'd get on a whiteboard and start, you know, architecting out an entire solution set from the software that IBM sold. But, you know, it really was having a seat at the table and having a voice and allies that got me there and supporters. So it's, you know, I'm not going to say I did it on my own, although I did challenge myself to do those things, you know, get the certifications, prove myself that I, there was a reason I had a seat at the table and it wasn't because of her ass, so to speak. Look, the other thing I'll say is a woman in business and raising two sons, and my sons now are 19 and 17. So again, a lot older now, but back then and doing the balancing act, a lot of people don't know the story, and I'm fine to tell it. Like, I was a widow, and so they've since been adopted. I've since remarried. But that said, I was at IBM, and then I went over to Visa. And I remember when my son was like 8 or 9 years old. I have to tell the story. He was like 8 or 9 years old. He had a friend come over for a play date. We had just remodeled our kitchen in Silicon Valley, so California, you know, nice house, and it was an open kitchen plan and big island in the house. And his little friend, who was like 8, came over and he said, "Wow, Wesley, what does your dad do?" And I was open kitchen plan. So I was like thinking, okay, I'm just going to let this go. What is my son going to say? Right. And He said, well, my mom's the vice president at Visa, right? So he really like picked up the, I taught him well. But the other part of the story is a month later, he was going to a play date at a friend's house. And so I was driving him in the car. We're going to his friend's house and it's Silicon Valley, right? So it's like the big gates open. It's a big, you know, you're going up this gated house or this huge mansion, right? I'm like, oh my gosh, here we go. So I'm driving him to his play date. The gates open, we're going up, and he looks over at me from the passenger seat and he's like, wow, mom, I wonder what his mom does. And I was like, yes, I've done it. Like, I've created an ally, you know, and I think that was when I knew, forget about my career, like, I'd made it in life, right? I made it in like showing equality, and like having my son say that to me was a big moment in being proud of a woman and being a woman in business. Sure. In general.
You clearly have worked extremely hard in order to get where you are. Do you think it's been harder for you as a woman to get to where you are than as a male?
Oh, wow. Yes or no? I don't know that that's a yes or no answer, right? I think it depends. Everyone has their own struggles, whether male or female. So it would be hard to say. I'm sure there's men who have, you know, there's disabilities or gay and lesbian, or other inclusionary areas that make it difficult, whether you're a man or a woman. So, yeah, I wouldn't say that it was more difficult or less because it would depend on each individual. That said, I've had a lot of allies throughout the years. And some of the things that we do at WorldPay, which I really enjoy, is we have many diversity and inclusion groups, even families, right? Because like you were saying earlier, being a parent and having a career and those things, there's a balancing act that has to take place. So we even have diversity groups for parents. It's interesting that you should ask like those, you know, black and white questions, because I don't think those answers are ever as absolute, if you will.
No, that's fair enough. Talking about balance, and everyone talks about work-life balance, right? Everyone talks about it, and it's all over social media, what have you. But you've been there. You've had, and you still have, high-powered roles. Or your children are old now, self-sufficient. But you wind the clock back 10 years; they weren't. They needed mum around. How did you balance your career progression with family life? How did you do that?
Yeah, you know, you have to take your breaks. I felt both. I was a better mom because I was working. I had my breaks, and I really enjoy technology. I really enjoy fintech and learning something new every day. And, you know, it made me personally a better person and a better, you know, mom and wife and family member. And then I had to take my breaks. It was like, okay, I'm taking, and when I did, you just have to, as a leader as well, just shut it off completely. I need to get better at that because sometimes I will respond to an email or two, but if I have any of my colleagues watching this today, they're going to be like, yeah, right. She's always responding to emails, even on a weekend. But there are critical things that happen at end of quarters, especially in a commercial organization. But yeah, you have to have the balance. You have to know when to shut it off and spend the time with the family as well. I'm learning myself how to have that balance as we go along. I had a lot of help. I had a lot of assistance, right? I had my mom was a huge advocate and helped watch the kids and family. I was actually lucky in that sense. I think a lot of people don't have family nearby that can help them with young ones. I had an au pair. I also did really well on the commission side of things when I was an individual contributor selling early in my career, and therefore, you know, had the luxury of being able to hire an au pair to live in with us, which I really needed at the time because I was traveling a lot. I still am traveling a lot, but it was really just the support system and, yeah, your own mental breaks that you need to take. I would just suggest that we can't do it all, right? I mean, it's impossible to say there's like this work-life balance. Like, it's kind of like the mom guilt that I've had or that. But it is interesting to think about, you know, at the end of the day, on my deathbed, am I going to think, oh, wow, I missed that one board meeting that I at 9 a.m. last Thursday. Like, that's the last thing I'm going to be thinking about. The first thing I'm sure I'm thinking about is, I miss my son's, you know, baseball game or my daughter's ballet or something like that. And that's really the things that we have to prioritize. And yeah.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And is it harder, you know, obviously you work your whole career for global organizations. Is it harder having a global role with global teams to have that disconnect? Because you've got multiple time zones, pretty much 24 hours a day, you've got operations running. And as a leader, and I appreciate you've probably got, you know, a layer beneath you, but there's always going to be escalations. There's always going to be an issue. There's always going to be a client that wants something that can't be delivered or a problem. Is it harder in a global organization to switch off as a leader?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I don't know. It might be more difficult if you're in one zone. It's just because we have so many resources as a global organization. We do have a 24-hour clock. That means there's somebody around the world always on. And it depends on the team and the structure and the organization and the processes and procedures that are in place. And I've had the luxury of working for really good companies, both like moral, ethical, life balance, you know, companies who really believe in those things, and not just as a mission statement or as a vision or a strategic pillar, but actually fundamentally act and show that they believe in these things. So I think it might be easier with a large global organization because you do have that base. You have that, if you're in a smaller startup and you're scrappy, right? And there's only two or three of you, or maybe, you know, 10 in your department, you might actually be working a lot more in that sense because you're wearing so many different hats. Although I would say lately I've been wearing a lot of hats as well. But that said, yeah, you just have to learn how to delegate and work with your peers across the regions. It's tough being in Europe. It's really easy with the U.S., especially the East Coast from our difference. Of course, South Africa and Africa, it's easy as well because we're kind of in the same time zone. The tough one for me from here would be Asia Pacific. I think that time zone is a tough one from where I sit today. And it's just, you know, recognizing that your peer across the pond also has a time zone. And we do have to be on call sometimes together. So sometimes I'm giving and sometimes they're giving, right? So I recognize that, wow, I know it's your 3 a.m. right now, but this call needs to happen. But then the next time we'll make sure that it's my 3 a.m. So I have great peers in the business globally that recognize time zones and families. Yeah.
Just want to come back on a point, and you mentioned it about working for organizations who truly believe and embrace sort of this diversity, inclusion, bit of flexibility. I think a lot of companies are guilty these days of waving the diversity flag, you know, changing their logo to, you know, the pride colors during, you know, Pride Month, stick it on their website as one of their sort of missions or whatever it may be, but really doing it just to tick a box. How would one, if we're talking about someone, whether it be a female, whether it be someone from the LGBT community, whether it be someone else who doesn't sort of conform to the norm, going to look for a new job, going to look for a new employer, how would someone in that position be able to really get to the DNA of that business and know whether they really are truly an inclusive organization or whether it's just, you know,
I BS. Think, well, look at the leadership team, right? I think that could be a clue. If the leadership team is also diverse in nature, now it depends on the size, right? Because sometimes it's difficult and in fintech even more. I also want to, it's a tough one, right? Because how do you from outside of a company when you're interviewing, it's asking a lot of questions, talking to as many people or your network as you can to get some insights about how the company operates. But easily on a webpage, usually, you know, there's the show, you know, about us and who the leaders are, you know, is it diverse in the sense that there's, you know, women representatives, and especially in fintech and payments, as I mentioned earlier, like that's like our end customer essentially, you know, is the a woman in a household. And it's interesting too, because I was talking to, anyway, not to digress from that, but really it's about understanding where the leadership opportunities and the development opportunities. Diversity is one thing, but inclusion is another. And I think that that's an important, and everyone's always used the analogy of like, oh, I invited them to the party. You know, it's a diverse party, invited everyone. But then the question is, did you invite them to dance once they got to the party, right? Did you invite, you know, the Black woman, the handicapped person, you know, the gay man or woman, you know, to actually dance and participate. And inclusion, I think it should be, we always say D&I, and at our company at WorldPay, we say IMD, we call it inclusion and diversity. And we put the inclusion first, and we're purposeful in that, because it's one thing to be diverse. And I guess that's the question, you know, just to be asked, quite frankly, you know, how do you run your inclusion and diversity programs, and see what the response is. Do they get really nervous when you ask the question? Just, you know, body language and those type of things, really, it can be an indicator to whether you want to be a part of that organization. Or maybe they're looking for diverse folks to bring into the organization because they don't have it. So purely the black and white of, well, I scrolled on the about us and it's all white men, but they're interviewing me, maybe I don't want to go. Like, you can make a change. Like, everyone can make a change and be part of the solution to the problem that they might have as well. So I don't think that we can judge a book by its cover either, because they could very much be interviewing and looking for those candidates. I would say, like, there's a book called The Confidence Code. And in the Confidence Code, it talks about men and women and applying for jobs and applying for roles. And it talks about, like, men, you know, look at a job requirements and they'll hit like two or three. They're like, yeah, I could do that. I've done that before. Yeah. You know, they totally, you know, they have the confidence, right, that they can do it. They can get this role. And whether they only hit like two or three of the 10 list of job requirements, well, a woman will wait till she has, yes, I can do that. I have this requirement. We'll wait till she has checked off at least 70, if not 100% of the job requirement before they even apply for the role and put their hat in the ring, right? So I just encourage women, like, don't do that. Just, like, take the leap of faith and have the confidence to put your resume forward, because we're looking for more diversity within our teams as well. Even though we do have a good, diverse leadership team today, we're always looking for more.
You're quite right. It's what does diversity mean to that organization? I know we're going a little bit off topic, but I think this is important for people listening. What does diversity mean for that organization? You know, I remember winding the clock back a couple of years, probably 3 or 4 years ago, actually, just before COVID. I went to see a customer in South Africa, and they were walking me around their sort of business, various different departments. And they said, oh, this is our product team.
Yeah.
Okay. And I said, who are you designing products for? And they're like, well, everyone. You know, it's just like it's a mobile wallet. Everyone. I said, well, everyone. Yeah, everyone. You know, it doesn't matter. I said, but these are all guys. So I said, do you not have women using your platform? And he looked at me and went, well, of course we do. I said, well, who's looking from the UX perspective or the UI perspective from a woman? You know, because, yeah, I know, you know, my girlfriend, when she's on her phone, she uses it very differently to how I use my phone. She holds it differently. She types like a million, you know, million words a second. And she enjoys a different experience. You know, she really enjoys sort of a Samsung, the Android. I can't stand it. I'm an iOS all the way through. And I think just from a diversity perspective, if you have a diverse team, especially in things like product or marketing, you know, you then get different opinions. Right. You get an opinion from a woman, from a man, from someone from a different community, from someone from a different. Let's not forget, age is a big factor here as well. Right. You know, there's a lot of issues around hiring people sort of towards the tail end of their careers, or maybe even those that are saying, listen, I've kind of made my money. I've climbed the corporate ladder. I really enjoy doing this, whether it be coding, whether it be whatever it may be. And I just want a job, right? Because I'm too young to retire. I feel too young to retire, even though my sort of passport says something else. And I think giving people an opportunity, regardless of age, gender, sexual orientation, creed, whatever it may be, to come into a workforce, especially a global organization where you are looking at global markets, you're looking at global consumers, you're looking at consumers across a whole breadth of society, and be able to build or modify products that suit various different demographics, because everyone's different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. I think it's interesting because we talked about like competitors or like, you know, when you build things out and like, oh, how do we build this better than this or this better? And it's like, your competitor isn't just who's in your industry. It's the last best digital experience that person had, right? Like, it doesn't matter if you're buying a ticket on Expedia.com or Booking.com. Like, that's not the competition, is each other. The competition might be my last digital experience that I had with, the grocery app. Wow, that was a really good one. I'm going to compare my next digital experience to that. And you're right, as a buyer or as a consumer, so fintech needs to really think about that and diversity that you said is needed. I absolutely agree with you. Gender is one thing, but generational is another. And generational, WorldPay also does a generation report. So we do the global payments report, and we also do a generation report, which talks about, you know, the consumer, the end consumer, and how they like to buy, a boomer versus a Generation X or Gen Z and it's really interesting, right? Because some are like, oh, I don't really trust that app, or I don't want to buy, you know, do they buy with their mobile? Do they buy with a desktop? Do they buy, you know, all of these kind of trends? Do they use a wallet? Do they use, you know, their mobile phone? And so, yeah, check out our generational payments report as well, because it's very interesting and lots of insights about generation. So you're right. I mean, we need to hire all of the above for diversity, and then we need to include them in our designs of our products and solutions. We need to include them in our designs and our thought process, and having an inclusive mindset at the table, because those are all of our, and actually, you know, the boomers are the ones that are going to have the money right now.
Yes, but there's also people like my 91-year-old grandmother, right, who now shops online on her iPad. And that's what she does. Now, has an app been designed for a 91-year-old? Probably not. I imagine it's quite a niche market for e-commerce for 90-year-old pluses. But, whatever she's using in the UK, I think it's Tesco, I'm allowed to say that. They've made it so sort of intuitive that she's able to do it, right? And I think my cousin loaded her credit card on, so she just goes along and she taps and it's delivered within 24 hours. So she's at the other end of the spectrum in terms of consumers. Again, probably not a massive market for someone to go over, but I think there's lots of opportunities. Tracy, I do want to talk about something else, if I may, and this is going to be completely off topic what we've just spoken about. We have a difference of opinion on something. I'm going to use this for the last bit of the session to talk about it. So it's not about diversity or inclusion. It's not really about global expansion strategies. It's not about working for massive corporates. It's about this thing called the metaverse. So when we had dinner, granted we did have a couple of glasses of wine, The metaverse conversation came up because I think you presented, which I'm unfortunately I missed that session. And I think my reaction was to you was, listen, that's nothing. It's going to peter out. It's going to be another kind of, I don't know, fidget spinner or something. I could see by your face, you were like, hang on.
Does tie back to what we were saying earlier, because it's a generational thing, right? I mean,
Right. So explain it. Can you unpack from your perspective? Convert me. I'm here to be converted, right? Convert me to being an advocate for the future of the metaverse, payments in the metaverse, commerce in the metaverse. Because I'm showing my age now as well, Tracy. I'm sitting there going, Really? Like, I've got to sit with a headset on. I haven't got time for that. I must just go on my phone and do it. So talk to me.
So yeah, so let's talk about what we have to define the metaverse first, right? I mean, we can't really talk about the metaverse without defining what it is. But I think we're, so baby steps into the metaverse might be some retail retailers, for example, virtual reality. So, you know, IKEA, how does that sofa look in my living room, right? So you take a picture of your living room and then you can like place the sofa with the measurements and say, oh, it actually looks really good. I'm going to go ahead and buy it. Ray-Bans has a virtual reality, which is kind of like the baby step into the metaverse, where you can try on different sunglasses and see how they look on your face. And actually, it's very realistic. I had a friend who, during COVID, needed some sunglasses to sit out on her backyard, you know, patio, and, tried the app and was like, oh, look, these sunglasses look really good on me. So bought them e-commerce. They were shipped to her home. She put them on. They looked exactly like they did in the virtual reality, right? So I think a baby step into the metaverse is really the things like VR, the number of VR headsets that are being sold, things like Fortnite, Minecraft, you know, these gamers that are in. This is a metaverse, right? You're using an avatar, you're buying a shield or a weapon, you're creating your persona. This is considered a metaverse, right? And so what the idea of the metaverse for me in the future of payments, it's already there, right? I mean, people are buying, there was a friend of my son, the World Craft, I can't even remember what it was like. He had a figure that he ended up selling for like $20,000 equivalent to sell like his like World Craft. Yes, I know. You're like, yeah. Wow. So these payments are happening in the metaverse today already. The topic of concern today is it's disjointed, right? So you've got money that only can work in Fortnite, and you have an avatar that only works in Fortnite, and then you have another one in Minecraft, and then you have, you know, points and coins in Minecraft. You have another, you know, over here. And so the idea is, how do you make it not disjointed, where you can be the same avatar, avatar in Minecraft as you are in another site, and be able to actually do commerce with the same coins in those, right? So it's kind of like, if you think about it, like different countries, we talk about cross-border. So instead of like these different metaverses, which we have in, you know, euros in Europe, or Zara Rand in South Africa, or, you know, Swedish krona in Sweden, we do cross-border payments today. We do that in real life. But in the virtual world, it's like, how do we end up having... And then we start to get into DeFi and blockchain and all of these other conversations. But it's really an interesting one when you talk about the metaverse. Is, you know, it's a generational thing. I do see it happening. I don't think there's been a huge adoption yet, but I wouldn't discount the metaverse in the next, you know, 10, 15 years from the early adopters kind of moving on. MTN, right? The largest South African network of phones, et cetera, cell phones and mobile. They've invested in Zululand. They've invested, there's a couple of metaverses in South Africa in particular, which is near and dear to you, I know. So take a look at it. Even the AI social, like social influencers. So there's AI social influencers that there's a gal, and I can't remember. Oh, Michaela. She has over a million followers, and she's a 19-year-old social influencer, and brands actually pay this avatar AI to like wear the clothes, hang out on the beach, do, you know, advertise their stuff. And she's an Instagrammer, but she's not real. She was created in 2018 and she was 19 then. It's 2024. She's still 19. So there's some advantages of the metaverse.
I don't know. I think the first couple of things that you mentioned, so the augmented reality, I get that, right? I really, really do. And, you know, I think there was an app on, was it Facebook Messenger that came up? And I saw a kid playing on it, and they were like, you're putting lipstick on, and the lipstick was different colors, and they could see on the screen. It was very cool, right? Yeah. So I get it from the augmented reality. But when it comes to and I get it for gaming. I really do. So if I'm playing my FIFA game and I want to buy, you know, a certain shirt and I want a name on the back of the shirt and I want a certain hairstyle and I'm going to pay tokens or money, whatever. I get that. I'm playing this golf game at the moment on my phone, and you know, I'm never ever going to buy anything for a game. I just not me. Do you know how close I've been to buying tokens? Because I'm just at that level, and I just need to get to that next point. Anyway, so I see it from a gaming perspective. But if we talk about real world commerce, do you see a point in the future where e-commerce, as we know it now, as in going to a website or going to an app, will be replaced by you going to a virtual store or virtual shop, being able to try things on virtually, so kind of the next advancement of AR, and then sort of within this metaverse environment. And I think, you know, with the launch of the Apple product, it's not called Apple Glass.
The eyewear.
Vision, is it?
Yes.
The eyewear, yeah. So I think with the launch of that, and obviously that's first iteration. I can imagine in 5-6 years' time, it's going to be, you know, pretty slick glasses like this, and you know, it's going to be displayed rather than having this great big contraption around you. So, do you think that's the future? Can you see e-commerce migrating into or evolving into that?
I think, you know, it's going to be in addition to what we know omnichannel is today, right? I don't know that it's 100% of the future, because there's card present and card not present world. And then, you know, that falls into kind of that omnichannel world. It will come. I think it's going to be slow, but I do believe, we disagree on this topic, but let's stay connected for the next 15, 20 years and see where we're at, I suppose.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I do.
Yeah, I can imagine my grandmother wearing a virtual reality headset and, you know, walking her little wheeler around Tesco. I'm not sure.
There's a lot of companies investing in it. Starbucks is case in point. I mean, they have a virtual reality NFT where you can get points within their world, their virtual world, and you know, you go in and you can do a tour of a coffee farm in, you know, Southeast Asia, or coffee farm in South America. And so the ones that you do, and then you get points through NFTs, and then you can take those out and actually pay for it for a real coffee in the real world, I guess you could say. So Starbucks has a virtual world like that. There's a lot of merchants that are investing in what is the metaverse. Maybe you haven't heard of it. Have you not heard of it?
You were doing so well. You were almost convincing me. Then you came up with this Starbucks thing. I'm like, what?
Look up Starbucks in the metaverse and their NFT program. And you absolutely can get points and rewards in the app. So there's a lot of companies, big, large multinationals, that are getting into the metaverse. Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm not going to get into the NFC conversation. No. But just to finish off, I do have one other sort of topical question, and that's on cryptocurrency, CBDCs. I know this is a whole other topic where we could spend another 5 hours talking about, and I appreciate that. But from a world perspective, do you see cryptocurrencies, certainly when it comes to cross-border payments, being used as a utility? Is there initiatives in place at the moment with Worldpay to sort of accept and process cryptocurrencies? How does that work with regulations? Obviously, there was a big news last week with the XRP ruling in the States, and I'm still waiting for the XRP to go to $100, but it hasn't. So anyway, what's kind of Worldpay's view, and maybe your personal view?
So I'm a crypto believer. I have some crypto. I haven't, you know, invested the farm in it, but that said, yes, and WorldPay absolutely is in the crypto space. We settle in USD stablecoin, so we do settlement in crypto as well today. It's an interesting, so we do have experts in the area of crypto. It doesn't fall under my jurisdiction, if you will. But that said, absolutely, WorldPay is in the space. I'm absolutely a believer in where it's going. I think that it's going to be, it might look a little bit different than it does today, right? There was, but yes, I do believe there are merchants that are looking to accept crypto and do, and then also settle in stablecoin is what we settle in today. But yeah, I mean, that's a whole, yeah. Like you said, we could spend hours on that particular topic. There's a lot of regulation. I think, did you mention CBD as well? We're also, you know, in
CBDCs. Yeah, well, CBDCs,
we're also looking very much into that space. And particularly, I think, starting out in North America and then, you know, branching out, we have a lot of fun, like testing different markets, right? I mean, that's one thing about being in a global company. You can test things in certain niches and areas and then make repeatable processes that then you can roll out elsewhere. So,
Oh, that's super fascinating. Tracy, thank you. Thank you so much. I know you've got like 100 countries you've probably got slacking you or teams in you or whatever.
It was beeping in the background. It might have been beeping.
No, not at all. No, I've learned to mute my notifications. I put it on do not disturb mode now. I've learned the hard way. But I really wanted to thank you for your time. You know, we've covered some important topics in, I hope, quite a relaxed, you know, way. And hopefully some of our viewers and listeners, you know, can take something out of this and apply it to their careers and their businesses. And, you know, who knows, we might all meet each other in the metaverse at some point. I'll probably be the last there. But anyway, Tracy will be there first. So if you want to see Tracy, look her up on LinkedIn. She's very active. Last picture I saw was her dressed as an air hostess in an Emirates outfit, clearly getting to know her clients very well. So that's the last time I saw Tracy online. Feel free to follow her. What I will do, for those of you who are watching on YouTube, I'll put the link to the Global Payments Report here as well. I'll put a link to Tracy's LinkedIn. For those of you who are listening on Spotify or on Apple or Google or any other platform, we will try and put some links in here as well. So you'll be able to access those. If not, have a look at worldpay.com, and you'll be able to navigate to the resources, and it's free to download there. So it's very insightful. There's a lot of information, but I certainly found it an interesting read. Tracy, thank you very, very much. I will let you go and enjoy your weekend in Madrid. Very jealous. I hear you've got a bit of a heat wave, so don't get sunburned.
Thanks.
My pleasure. Tracy, thank you again.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of Talking Success. Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us for this fascinating discussion on all things fintech. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and have gained some valuable insights into the ever-evolving world of finance and technology. A huge thank you to our guests for sharing their expertise and providing us with some amazing insights. We certainly couldn't have done this without them. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and stay tuned for more exciting conversations with experts in the field. Until next time, keep learning, keep growing, and keep talking success.